Hi, this is Catherine, just dropping in to say hi and to tell you that both Kate and I have newsletters. My newsletter is called Highbrow, Lowbrow, Mediumbrow, and hers is called The Bowerbird. Both are on Substack. We'll put links on the First Time Instagram feed and on our website, and we would love if you would subscribe. Thank you.
Happy summertime, First Time listeners, or happy wintry new year to our listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. My name is Kate Mildenhall, and my co-host here at the First Time podcast, Catherine Collette, and I are both at the beach. Maybe some of you are too, but we wanted to give you some ear happiness over our break. So we've put together our top 10 episodes ever for you to revisit and get you inspired for a new year of writing and reading and creativity. Welcome to our summer series. Happy summer and happy listening. The First Time podcast records on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Sarah Winman grew up in Essex and now lives in London. She attended the Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Art and went on to act in theatre, film and television. Her first novel, When God Was a Rabbit, was an international bestseller. Her second, A Year of Marvellous Ways, was a Sunday Times bestseller, and Tin Man, her third novel, was shortlisted for the Costa Novel Award in 2018. Winman's latest novel, Still Life, published in 2020, was an instant Sunday Times bestseller, a Guardian Best Book of 2021, and winner of Dimmick's Book of the Year 2021. Sarah Winman, it's such a pleasure to be speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm really, really glad that you invited me. So, yes.
So I'm giving our listeners some context to each of these interviews in our master series, as we're calling it at the moment, as to why someone ended up on Catherine or my wish list. And for you, Sarah, I think I read Tin Man, your third novel, Tin Man, in about 2018. I just looked back on my Instagram to find it, and it utterly broke me, but in the very best of ways, as books do. And foolishly, I did not immediately go back and read your other work. So it wasn't until this summer, Australian summer, that I read Still Life and went, oh God, this woman and her words, I must read everything and I must be wowed, as so many other people have been, by your work. So it's a true thrill to have you here in one spot where I can just pepper you with questions about your writing and your craft.
Yes, do. I mean, I was trying to think about that. We were going backwards and forwards, and then I saw you posting a couple of things, and I thought, oh my God, When God Was a Rabbit, do I even remember the character? And I'm like, you just move on, don't you?
You do move
on. You think
on.
You will never move on.
Yeah.
And then you do move on.
And then you do. Thank goodness. It's okay. It's not, I won't quiz you, I promise. It's not a pop quiz.
No. But it made me think. It made me think about passage of time. And, you know, when I wrote that book, and the years of when I wrote that book would have been between 2007 and 2009. And I gave it in at the end of 2009. So it's suddenly, you know, life becomes, you divide life up, or you understand your life by the books that you've written, I suppose, and what went on there, because each book is very, very clear to me of different sort of events in my life.
Mm. Chapters in themselves.
Yeah, completely.
In a beautiful interview you did with Matilda Bookshop, you said, storytelling is what I do to be me. And I want to ask you, when you first realised in your life, perhaps as a child, that you were a storyteller, and in what form that storytelling first took?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I realised it at the time, but I do remember probably the first thing that I wrote. I was little. I was probably about, so I was in primary school. I was 7 or 8. The headmistress was a woman called Mrs. Dunstan. And I'd just been to see the famous Tutankhamun exhibition at the British Museum. And I came back and I said, you know, and I wrote a play about it that I was in. And I said to Mrs. Dunstan, I think we really need to put this on in assembly. And she agreed. She was remarkable. She agreed. And so we did put this play on. And I don't have it. I can't quite remember. It was obviously about the discovery. You know, you soak up everything and then you make it yours. The discovery of Tomb of Tutankhamun. And then she said, I think she stood up at one point, she said, assembly is over. And I went, we're not finished yet. But I think we had to finish. And I think, you know, that was a mix. That was, I wasn't a great reader, even at that age, but I liked films and I liked going to see people perform and I liked that area of storytelling. So books didn't really feature heavily for me at that age. So it would be very, it was more that I liked playing, and that's what acting was. And I did enjoy telling a story. And then I used to do odd bits and pieces at school, like write pantomimes and like satirical stuff. So that's how I came in, probably from that kind of more audience stroke performer kind of way in. And that was purely because I wasn't really reading.
And that's obviously what, you know, your career was, because you have this very interesting, in a way, path to first publication, in that you already had this long career as an actor before When God Was a Rabbit.
It was too long. It was so No, it really was. It did a lot of harm. I just couldn't let it go. It was too long.
So tell us about that moment when you made this shift, when you said, okay, this is now the past and I'm going to move towards writing. How did it happen?
It wasn't as dramatic as that. And I never intended one being the past and one being now. I thought I was never going to give up acting. But I don't think that was a healthy and a conscious decision. I really didn't know what else to do. And that's a sad thing. You know, when you go, I can't do anything else. Mm. And that's partly about your own mental health. That's partly about your own confidence, your own agency, to actually have confined yourself so small, you know, and I did, I suppose. So there was a number of things. There was a few live things. I was struggling acting. I wasn't really doing much. And I'll be honest, you know, I had some debt and I was finding that a little bit overwhelming. So I just didn't know the way out. And I had one of those life moments. My father was really ill, actually, and which would eventually lead to his death. But at that point, we were probably 2005. So he was about 5 years off. And when you get moments like that, things don't matter in the same way. It was as simple as that. It was like, oh, I'll deal with debt. What I knew was that my parents needed help, you know, very clearly. And my dad didn't really want help from outside the family. So they needed help. And he was in and out of hospital for a long time at a hospital very close to me. So it meant that I could be there. I would sort of do the morning shift. And I got so much out of it, you know, and whatever healing needed to happen with parents, that happened, which wasn't a great rift. But, you know, you just get older. It's just those things. Mm-hmm. And I used to go to this place called Bunhill Fields, a very old nonconformist cemetery, very known for William Blake being buried there, very close to where I live. And I used to go there every day. So I went there every day for at least a year, which forced me to look and to look about. So I would sit in at the same bench and I would have the same view, but I would have the shifting of seasons and the shifting of light. And then I would go to the hospital and then we'd come back. And while I was doing this, I thought, well, this is all very well, but I really need to do something for myself creatively. And I didn't know if I was going to go and do an open university degree, because I really wanted to learn something. And that was my main kind of impulse. And then I just thought, why are you starting? You know, I've got this habit of going from naught to sort of 60 or 70. So why don't we just go? There was an adult education center called City Lit nearby. And I found the leaflet for it. And they did describe it as creative writing, but I've always said it wasn't creative writing because my knowledge of creative writing is so different from that course.
Yeah.
It was looking at text in a very light way. And we were doing novella at the time and very basic about place, time, character. And there was a mix of people, mainly people there because it was a hobby and it was just, you know, something to do really that was interesting. And we had a teacher who was a poet and she was amazing. And she would say at the end of every session, you know, if you want to do this exercise, do it. And you can read out your work next week or don't. And that was perfect for me because by this point, I'm still writing screenplays, hoping that it would get made, which of course they won't because it's a completely different structure. You know, it's easier to get a novel published than to get a screenplay or a play made. There you go. Anyone watching? So there you are. So I knew writing. I knew I could sit at a desk. I knew I'd done that. That sort of, one doesn't want to call it a discipline with hard edges, but I knew I had that kind of passion to do. So I'm in this class and I did two terms and I got 40,000 words of prose. And my acting agent was affiliated with a literary agency at the time. And I handed the prose, the 40,000 words, to him. And I said, is there anyone in literature who could read this and see if it's any good? And he said, sure, of course. And then 2 days later, I had a call from an agent called Robert. He said, we need to have lunch. And I had lunch with him. And he said, I'm your agent. I need another 25,000 words. And that was it. So after 30 years of struggling as an actor, the path to being, to getting an agent, I wasn't published with that book, which, if we want to be really complex, that book was called Tin Man and was the original Tin Man of what became. But of course, it was nothing like it because it was written in 2005, 2006. And it was absolutely right that it wasn't published. But that it was kind of easy, which is a strange thing compared to what I went through acting and all the rejection and all the, you know, the difficulties, which most people will know if they are actors or in the that kind of creative arts, that it was hard. And then suddenly this door opened.
So when that door opened, and I had read somewhere that that it wasn't that first manuscript that did get published first. So were you then encouraged to write something else? And if so, how so? And how did you get it to come out? I'm getting the sense now of this discipline you already had as sitting down and kind of facing the page, I suppose, which is what so many people find daunting. Yeah. How did you come at that next manuscript, which obviously became When God Was a Rabbit?
Well, Robert thought, he absolutely swore that Tin Man, that original, that would be published. He said, there's no way it can't be published. And he said at the time, you know, they're going to want a book quite quickly from you if we publish this. And I was like, oh, okay, all right, well, we can do that. So, I mean, I still write like this. I just didn't really, I was thinking there going, well, I don't have a story. I don't really. And then we found out it wasn't published. Mm. And so there's a little bit of a little bit of tension between what you've asked me in that moment. So it wasn't published. And I remember an actor friend of mine said, oh, Sarah, don't worry. You know, I know somebody who took 4 attempts to get published. And I was like, I don't have it in me. I absolutely, at this point in my life, with this, you know, with the acting going kind of pear-shaped, I don't have 4 rejections in me. And I knew that. I was like, phew. And then I was on a train coming down to Cornwall. And this is very significant for me. I'm realizing that movement away from home is very creative. And I was just sitting on this train thinking, what if I moved a family from London to Cornwall? Mm. What would that be? What would that be like? I loved the first person narrative at that point in my life. I would have been very taken with probably the first adult book I'd read that had given me the impetus to really carry on reading. And that was A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving, which is a long time ago. But as I said, I came late to it. So I was probably in my late 20s. Mm. But I was taken with the light and dark of that book. It was the dark humour, the brilliance of the humour particularly. So that had stayed with me. So it was that. It happened pretty quickly after, you know, I need to cry and feel all those things. I think less so now, but at that point I was still a person of extremes. So I needed to let it out and all of that, you know, why it hasn't happened for me. That slight nudge of victimhood, you know, that you can get. And to acknowledge it until something comes in and goes, yeah, well, we can't carry on this. More than anything, you've got a headache. So let's have some water and let's just move on. And you know what? You have an agent. And you have an agent who's so behind you, who so believes in you, and you've never really had that before. So come on, let's think of something else. And of course, Rabbit was the book. And it coincided with my father dying. So, and that is kind of significant because it allowed me to laugh. And we had so many moments of those last sort of 18 months, which of course weren't particularly good for him, but he still was somebody who had great humour. Mm. So, dark humour for that sort of last year or year and a half was around, and how you confront trauma and how you confront immense pain, and that occasionally laughter just happens and it helps. And so writing that book was a great balm in knowing in the ending of my father's life, because suddenly I realised that, you know, when you are in this kind of creative state, you are the director, you control it all. So I took this family on what was quite a dark journey, but I could change the ending in a way that I couldn't with us. And so that's what I started to, it's almost as if I needed that, which is an awful thing. You know, I'd love my father to be alive today. But, you know, I realize now that I work things out with my writing when I need to. I work things out, I confront fears with the writing, and the writing allows me to write characters that I can aspire to, I suppose, or to ways of being that I can aspire to.
Oh, ways of being that we can all aspire to as well. I've got so many questions, and the way that our conversation has begun, I could go in any direction, but I want to go to here, to the beginning, in fact, of Still Life, when there's this superb little section where Evelyn and Margaret are discussing Evelyn's encounter with E.M. Forster in Florence. And I hope that you'll forgive me if I read this back to you. I have
yeah, do.
Read. It's Evelyn says, "I remember he'd appear in quiet moments. You wouldn't hear him, just see him, tall and lanky in the corner or in the drawing room with a notebook, scribbling away, simply observing. Isn't that how it starts?" said Margaret, handing back the cigarette. "What? A book? Yes, I suppose so. Those little moments that nobody else notices, little sacred moments of the everyday." I want to ask you, Sarah, how do you pick up those? You've just told me one, that one on the train. Yeah. How are you recording and observing those little sacred moments of every day?
How do I do it? Well, I'm a big morning pages writer, so I do morning pages, and I've done that for a long time. It's sort of what I do, you know, and I try and do something. Some days I can't do three full scale, you know, 3 A4s.
Yeah.
But it's quite helpful. I always have a notebook with me wherever I go. The interesting thing is I've written less these last 2 years than I ever have in my life. I'm not sure I've found what has happened in the world particularly creative. I had a book to finish, so I suppose I was creative. So from March 2020, when we went into lockdown, I was giving in the book at the beginning of August, so I had to get cracking. Actually, it was the end of August. But since then, I haven't. I have struggled with what is the everyday. I don't know. I think I can only. I'm still working it out. I don't really have much to say. And I have this when people say, "What are you writing next?" I go, "Nothing. I've got nothing to say. I genuinely don't," because that psychic shift of the last 2 years. I don't know what it is, and I don't know what it means, and I don't really know what I can do with it yet. So I'm figuring that out. But the one thing I do know is that I'm not particularly creative, or the initial creative impulse, you know, that spurt when you're on the blocks and you need to get out, you know, that doesn't happen in the familiar. I need to be on the road. I need to be somewhere else. I need to be traveling, basically. I find the discomfort of the unfamiliar very creative. And I think that has been a symptom of the last 2 years, that it's been very familiar.
Yes.
And I don't create from that spot, really.
Yes, I think that's, we've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast, particularly with you know, writers here as they were, where you are, who were in lockdown for such a long period of time, that it's that tension against the second thing or the third thing that one needs, travel, like you said, or discomfort, or even just observing strangers, which is what you need to get it cracking.
You just need to be, yes, I do anyway. I need to just be away and having different conversations, or utter silence. I think that was the other thing. Room of one's own, or time.
Yeah.
A room of one's own, categorically. So I was in lockdown with my partner in a very small flat. We were in a studio flat for that first lockdown when I was trying to write. And I love her dearly, but I could hear her cough and I could hear her breathing. Literally, there was this, just a partition. And you know, you can't totally bitch about it because you are so focused, you have to do it. And I was in the story. So, you know, there's no problem. Had I had to try and create, I couldn't have done it.
Yes.
But I was in it. So it was really just headphones on, focus. But writing for me is privacy. No matter, and Patsy knows me more than anyone knows me. She knows me almost like I know me. And yet I still crave privacy. So it is the room of one's own. It can be the cupboard of one's own. But I do need that privacy. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen, really.
Let me ask you about that that privacy. And in fact, when your first book came out, because I wondered if there was a sense that you were more prepared for what a public facing kind of moment as an author might be because of your experience as an actor than the rest of us who all just feel like we're absolute imposters. Or did you feel that imposter syndrome as well?
Oh, no, totally, because I was an actor. I still felt an actor, and I was entering what would have been termed a more literary world. Mm. You know, I mean, it really wasn't that literary. I mean, the whole idea of literary now makes me laugh. But
exactly.
I did still feel an imposter, but I was prepared. I knew the public. I knew the public way of doing things. And actually, I enjoy an audience. And it's not the enjoyment of an audience of the, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, here I am. It's the relationship and the intimacy that happens in those moments in a bookshop at night, sometimes in winter when the light fades. And it always reminds me of the rehearsal room. Mm. And there's magic there because there will always be someone, and there always has been someone, who will reveal something incredibly profound about their life. And had they not turned up there and had they not read the book, that wouldn't have happened. Mm. And those are the things that I'm really grateful for. So I like talking to people, but I hope that the way I talk does impart information, because that's what they're there for, but also can allow them to reveal themselves. I think that's really important. So it's not my show, you know, as is most theatre. It's a kind of a symbiotic relationship that you're all involved in this moment. And that's what I really enjoy. And I'm pretty good at reading, and I'm pretty good at choosing the right reading. And I did offer this to my publisher, I suppose, a couple of years later. And I said, look, I can do this. I can help someone. If you've got some debuts around and they're not sure, I can give them some breathing techniques, and I can go through what would be a good section. Because what you want is something where you don't actually have to introduce much, you know, all
yes.
of that stuff. All these things that will make the reader coming into this public sphere confident, and nobody took it up.
You need to start a podcast, Sarah.
I don't.
Of course they will, because actually, you know, this leads me straight into that I listened to a recording, and I'll link to it in our show notes. It's you, I think, maybe even launching A Year of Marvelous Ways, and you read from it.
Yes.
And after which I immediately went and also bought the audiobook of A Year of Marvelous Ways. It is divine. And where you're saying about the intimacy, you can also hear in the recording, because it's a live recording, you can hear the audience gasp and ooh and, you know, moan with you. And, you know, I think any reader of your works would know that the dialogue kind of leaps off the page when they're reading it. But to hear you read it is just another experience altogether. Tell us about what you know about dialogue and reading and voice from acting that you have been able to bring into your books.
Yeah, I mean, good question. It's a hard one because most of this is quite organic. Mm. I wasn't a method actor. It's just organic. I kind of had a sense of how things were, really. I think it is dialogue and inhabiting a character go together because, of course, dialogue is the voice of a character. So there's no difference with that. So once you have that character, the voice starts to come. You know, you just get a rhythm. And then if you're working with, you know, it depends. You might have a two-hander, as I would say. And the voice is, there will always be a contrast because there was a contrast of ages and there's a contrast of sexes. And so it's not really hard to imagine. It's more about, I think, not being too clever. Mm. And the understanding that most everyday dialogue is really simple. But it's the intention that is the hard one. Mm. And so that should be thought about, that not to impart. You know, we always had it with acting. Don't give a character exposition. You know, don't use this as a plot turner or as, you know, trying to fill in. You're going to have to go back. If that's what you're doing, you are seriously going to have to go back and work out where this information needs to go, because it stops the narrative. And it's also, people don't talk like that unless you're a lawyer in court or a policeman. So, you know, in our conversation, it's short, but we know the words because we know the intention behind and we know the information we want to impart and we know the information that we hope to receive. And that's the key. you know, listening to people on buses. And it's so easy now because people say everything on buses or trains because they've got a phone, you know, or just eavesdropping. Eavesdropping, I've used dialogue from eavesdropping many times in books because it's funny. And that's the thing, you notice how people use words. Sometimes they get structures, you know, sentence structures wrong. I often, you know, a lot of my characters in still life, they speak in a very different rhythm, you know, so that's really it. Don't necessarily get your dialogue from telly because telly is, you know, I learned how to write from bad telly, of which I did much bad telly. So if you're going to rely on just sitting that, films are slightly different. There are some amazing writers. And there's also, of course, Succession. There's some incredible, you know, but there's also, you know, bad telly. And learn from that as well. If you're just sitting there and you're flicking through the channels and you feel like a bit, well, why are you bored? What has just happened? What don't you believe that character's saying? You know, start listening to it, because the voice and the dialogue is the character of the person that's speaking. It is as basic as that for me.
It struck me as I was listening to that reading that you did, the quality of what you must do inside your mouth and your throat to kind of get the different sounds is something quite extraordinary that most authors, I imagine, wouldn't have that skill. They haven't got that particular skill. Does it change the way you hear the voices in your head? Is that something that comes to you quite early?
Yes. I mean, if you're going with Marvelous, and Marvelous, I love Marvelous. I love reading Marvelous. Marvelous was, you know, it was a shape. So she was sort of this old woman and, you know, she'd had the weight of the world and she had stories and she was often lost in herself. So, you know, and she was, I gave her sibilant because obviously her teeth might not have been exactly as they were. So you start to then move everything to the front because she's connecting, and then the voice sort of drops behind because she's weak and she's, you know, she's just doesn't have that energy. And suddenly you've got the whole character there. You can work out from that moment what somebody can do and what somebody can't. You know, and it's, but you know, it that is from acting, and that's, but you can do it. Anyone can do it. But privacy, you don't need to know that somebody's sitting, you know, in the room while you're experimenting,
yes,
being a character. And that's what I mean. You need to just let go of all safety and embrace all freedom and let go of all self-consciousness and play. I mean, that's all that acting is, playing and being given permission to play as a child would play. And then you can start to hear the voice. And it might not be the exact voice because obviously I write male characters and I can't, but you get a slight kind of timbre that you can still work it in your head, and then it becomes much easier. Once you've got those two voices, you've got the shape of the character, you maybe have the face or the shape of their jaw, but that's much, much easier to then start writing the backwards and forwards of a conversation with people.
That is, I feel like I'm going to get off this call to you and like immediately start walking around my studio and experimenting with different body shapes, because even watching you do that, I was like,
the weight of the person, you know, if I think of still life, Pete, you know, he was always sort of jittery, but when he was at the piano, he was still. Oh. But his was up energy. I always saw it because, you know, he was riddled with guilt and all of those. But you start to, you just play with energy, and it's a nice feeling because then you start writing and you're there with them. And that is the simplicity, I think, of totally inhabiting. That it's almost as if, without being too weird, that, you know, you see people at psychic readings and the psychic person is there having somebody come into them. And it is really, it's like that. We're not playing sort of so esoteric here, but the absorption of a character must be completely bodily, you know. I think it's a great clue.
Let me ask you about some of these extraordinary characters you create. There's a wonderful Forster quote as one of the epigraphs for Still Life. Two people pulling each other into salvation is the only theme I find worthwhile. And, you know, all of your books, Sarah, have at their hearts these incredible relationships, friendships, siblings, found families, many times, as you've referenced, spanning great age gaps as well. Mm-hmm. Tell me about these characters, where they come from, and the relationships they form with each other.
Yeah, I think the Forster quote, when I found it, I was like, oh, but that's what I've always done. That's what I believe in every book. And it's what I believe in life. Mm. That who do we need to get through it? Because we do need someone. You don't need lots, you know, despite what you felt in your 20s or your teens. You don't need lots, but you do need one. Mm. And so that's really what I do, is they are, I suppose, they're redemptive novels. So the ending will be different to the beginning. The characters, they just come. The characters will come out of the story. It's, as I say, it's something that will come out of my body rather than me thinking too hard. If I think too hard about writing, I never use it. Huh. So after Rabbit, I was like, I am writing a first person narrative, probably of the First World War. Really? No, never touched it, had no interest. First person, definitely first person. Well, Marvelous was third, with chunks of first, just because it was fun. But every time I've made that kind of cerebral decision, I've never written a book. Mm. And so now I trust it that the feeling, the idea, and if we put it into visual sense, the story is sort of floating around and we'll find it. Mm. And I feel it's that, because it kind of tends to come out of the blue. And once I've got a rough feeling about where something is set and what it is, then things start to happen, you know. So Ulysses came first, which at the time I was surprised, because I thought, you know, in my mind, I thought it would be writing a woman's story and using that as a kind of a gender sort of specific term. So I was a bit surprised, but I was like, well, I'll go with it because I trust it. And then, of course, if we move that word, it's totally a feminine space book, you know, but he came first. Florence, obviously, the flood. I was over in Florence, had no intention of writing about Florence ever, still don't. But I was there and I saw these photographs on this restaurant wall of this city underwater, and I'd never heard about it, which, you know, the flood is fascinating, but it was the people who came to clear up.
From the Mud Angels.
She's not real. She's
what
not.
Comes well, next?
Yeah. Okay, so I learn about the flood.
Yeah.
Yes, the Mud Angels. And then I just go, oh, that's so romantic. I need romance with the initial idea of a story every time. And that's usually about place. So this kind of moving people. What is a place going to show somebody? What is it going to reveal about them that they don't know? Place is really important. I'm seeing more and more. And that's why I haven't written anything, nor am I that interested. And I think that's okay. Mm. Had this been, you know, a while back, I would have panicked. But it's okay.
It's okay.
So, Mud Angels. Then you start to go, then it becomes a slightly forensic. You start reading and you go, 1966. Ah, okay. So these were the kids of the war generation. You know, they're moving into Europe. They want to make a united Europe. They want to do something. So, okay, I've just said war generation. Okay, my grandfather was in Italy during the war, because that's what would have happened. Go back to Tin Man. I talk about working class, well, class and opportunity throughout my books. Okay, so we know that these young men signed up thinking war would be over, but it was a chance to travel. So we've got war. I don't really want to write about war, but I'm here and he's in Italy. Who else might be in Italy? I read another book by this man called Frederick Hart. You would have heard me talk about him. He was out driving around trying to find the works of art that had been sequestered in the hills to protect them from looting from the Nazis. And they came across this albergo, and there were many people having lunch as the bombs were going off and the artillery fire. And he said, and, you know, there was captains and there was Italian custodians and there's a couple of English spinsters. And I'm like, hello, who are you? Because it was something so incongruous and so beautiful. And I know these kind of women that no matter how bad it is, they can push it aside and enjoy a really lovely lunch. And so within that kind of framing, I had the first, you know, certainly couple of decades, and I had lots of things to sort of play with. And so that's it. So what it starts out is an organic sense of place and what somebody can be there and who can fall in love with the place or time, with themselves. You know, it's got to have that really richness, and it is like falling in love. And then we start to sort of move on from there, I think.
So in your research then, there's in still, I'll use still life as the example because it's the most recent. There's these, they almost sparkle, the details about the globe making, about East London and the canals as well, but about particularly the square in Florence, the food. And each of them, you think, as a writer, I suppose reading it as a writer, you think there are hours and hours of research and reading behind each of these little details. How do you decide what to put in and what to leave out?
Well, I loved globe making. So some of these things, I knew about globe making.
As in you've always loved globe making?
I've always loved globes. I've always loved globes. And I can see why now. I love the whole point where you just write things and then your beliefs are revealed at the end of a book. And that's why I think it's an incredible process to get to know yourself and to work out your own life. So I sometimes do writing, or I did before the pandemic, for a blog called Spitalfields Alive. And it's a blog all about, it's brilliant, by the gentle author. He's written tens of thousands of stories about the East End and about people who live and work, die there, and all the shifts. And I love the East End. You know, my parents were originally from Oxford, but then they moved to Leytonstone, which was East London. We always used to be around sort of Spitalfields. I'm very familiar with that kind of working class area, I suppose. You know, the other family I grew up with, Sylvie, my second mum, she was from Hoxton. I know that rhythm of speech. We had it with our family and when we were together. So I like that. Paul, so the gentle author, he wrote a piece about a man called Peter Bellaby. Peter Bellaby wanted to give his dad an 80th present of a handmade globe, and he couldn't find one anywhere, so he decided to make it. And it took him a long time. So he wasn't ready for his dad's 80th, but it was a very superb. He learned how to do it. Very different from when I did it, because you had computers and you could actually print out the gauze. But he did it, and he made plaster casts of the spheres. So he went back to basics, and he started to make them. And he now has a multi-million pound business. You can Bellaby & Co. on Instagram if anyone's interested. It's fabulous. And I went and spent an afternoon with him, and I said, how would they do it? How would they do it? I know in principle all of this, but we don't have access. And then he took me through, you know, the etching, copper plate etching, the reversal and all that. And it was fantastic. And it also, I needed Ulysses in the same way that if we go to Tin Man, I needed my male man hero to have dignity in his work. Mm. And a job that he'd love and would reflect him, and also would fit in with the city. So globe making in Florence, of course. So, you know, that I'd sort of known about. I did do a lot of research, but I was sort of skimming. Mm. So it makes me look as if I know a huge amount in the book. I know more than when I started it, but it's already starting to fade. You know, I'm always surprised about that incredible intensity that you get.
Yes.
That absolute submersion where, after a while, it's almost just so in tune with everything that you're doing. You go through a book and you scan and you go, oh yeah, that's great. And you scribble that down. I always put which book it's come from and the page number in case I need to go back and that. So that's something that I just learned. And you sort of build it up. So people think, well, I know all about, you know, St. Francis or the mendicants. It's like, I don't. I know pockets and I know where they were, but I don't need to be an expert on that. You know, the book that I read is. And it's the layering of that. Mm. Just, you know what? It's just things that interested me at the time and things that I would have fun with. And things that I could write light on the page, I suppose, rather than being really, really weighed down by too much information. Mm. And have I answered it?
Yes, you have. I think that curiosity.
I'm far away from your question.
No, it's the curiosity that comes through, I think, too. It's the things that leap off the page to you when you're reading are the same as what leap off the page for us.
I think exactly. You know that. Exactly.
I want to ask you about structure, because one of the very visceral memories I have of reading Tin Man is getting halfway through it and going, oh, what has she done? Like, are we allowed to do this? Is this, what is this structure? And, you know, I think now, having looked at more of your work, all of your books kind of have this playfulness with time, with structure, with place, with perspective. I wanted to ask, at what point you conceive of the structure? Does it intuitively come, or is it something that you kind of craft around as you're working through the narrative?
It's both of those things. I never studied structure, so I didn't study creative writing, as we just said, in that form after doing my little bit at City Lit. That was it. And so I feel as if I'm not answerable to anyone, you know, and that's good and not so good. So there are probably, there are areas where I suddenly go, well, I don't know how to do this. Whereas maybe if people had a more formal education, they would know how to get out of it. But what it means is I just keep plodding away at it. No, I don't know what the structure of a book will be. Tin Man, for instance, I knew it would be Ellis's story to start with, and that's where we're at the starting point. And it just made sense to write Michael's story. I mean, these are the things that I suppose it's the problem. I think it's the problem between the first and the second book. And it's the problem that publishers force on a writer, especially if they've had a little bit of success in their first book, that they don't give them time. And I've always taken time, and I've always demanded time, because I can't tell you how long this book is going to take. Even now I can't. I reckon 2 years, that seems to be the norm at the moment. But because I don't really know that it's going to be this, I need the space to keep carving away at it. And I suppose the easiest analogy is, that I've used it before, is like sculpture. And what you're doing is you're taking everything away that is not necessary until you absolutely have the form. And that's what it becomes. Mm. And a form that's right for you. So you carry on reading brilliant people, and you carry on reading people from the past and classics, and you start to work out how people do things, and what did you like about that? And then you think, okay, I'm going to make a note of that. And all those dog-eared pages turn down in a book because you look at how somebody has done something and you learn from that. And then you might incorporate it. But no, I don't sit there. I don't beforehand think this is how the structure is going to work out at all. It's something. So Still Life, I started a certain way. And the 1901 section was to remain like a book of its own. I think it's okay, but it might have made a little bit more sense for some people. My narrator was edited. My narrator was cut in the editing process, which I won't say anymore because I might use the narrator again because they were really lovely and brilliant. But
oh my gosh, they're just sitting out there waiting for a book.
So my editor, Helen, she was brilliant. She's just so fantastic. When she went through it and she says, you're going to hate me, but I want to cut your narrator. And I was like, by then I was like, yeah, okay, I can see why, because it was another character. And the character came in quite late, fabulously so, but the book still could work without them. And that was okay. So,
oh, I am so intrigued, Sarah. I mean, that's like the most tantalizing tease.
There was a voice in my head, and there was a reason, you know, why these certain rhythms, because I knew who this narrator was and why it was being written. I mean, I'm glad that I think for the majority of people it works, and it still works. I know some people don't, you know, like aspects of it, and that's very, very cool. That happens with the book. But so, you know, I could play with that. Once we've got that first section over, I could start to play also, you know, the roundup sections of some of the starting of the decades where we whizzed through. It seemed very doable to do that, as long as, you know, you were playing around each sentence, juxtaposing ideas and being incongruous, because that was like meeting somebody going, how have you been these last 5 years? Oh, no, it was amazing. Yeah, I bought a car. Yeah, my dad died. And then, we went on holiday. And then we did. And suddenly you just go, that is it, isn't it? People, you just get these sentence sound bites of somebody discussing what has happened in the last 5 years. Because they're, you know, I've got to go. I've just seen you. It's amazing. But I've got to catch a train. What's happened? Jump off. And it was almost like the engine, because I knew it was getting to be a big book. I mean, we did cut about 17,000 words, so it was even bigger. And I needed these moments of like vroom, vroom, to get us to the next, so that it didn't feel faltering, or that a reader would go, oh shit, no, it's only 1950. You know, to really give them hope, especially when it was like, you know, this happened and this happened, to say, you know, I'm on it. I know this is dragging. I know you're going to be really thinking, please, when is this going to end? But I am going to move you quickly over to the next slot, because I know what you're thinking.
So, oh my gosh. I love your, you know, your imagined reader in the brain. I actually want to ask two very specific questions that if you agree to this and we leave this part in, because it does involve spoilers, that I will tell listeners to, who haven't yet read Still Life, jump off now for a couple of minutes, because I'm going to ask Sarah two burning questions about craft and this story. Okay, the first one is your title, Still Life.
Yep.
There comes an utterly exquisite paragraph of writing towards the end of the book where the title words appear in a sentence in an entirely different way, with an entirely different meaning. It is the most magnificent play on words in the type of way that I think I, you know, I clasped my hands over my mouth or put it away and just said, ah, like, I'm done. That is so satisfying. I want to know, when did that paragraph come to you? Did that in fact come first? What came first? The title, the paragraph, the play on words? Tell me.
The original title, the working title, was called The Restoration of Ulysses' Temper. So that was it. It was a bit wordy. And then gradually, in brackets, it was Still Life. But it was The Restoration of Ulysses' Temper. And I don't write in order, so I know which paragraphs you're thinking. And I like that paragraph.
That's a beautiful paragraph.
For me, I think, I'm not sure I can write a paragraph like that again. And that's not, you know, anyone listening, I'm not waving and going, I said, and this is it, you know, Kate, as a writer, it's not like going, oh my God, this is the best paragraph. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What I'm saying is thought, heart, action all came together in such a rare way that I might not write a paragraph like that again, because you don't always. But I sat there. I remember I was writing in bed. It was a Sunday and I was feeling it. I was feeling a bit down. And I just finished, come back. I'd finished the 1901. And there was such this sense of time passing and nostalgia and for Evelyn. And it sort of summed her up, really, that paragraph. And it was that paragraph that made the 1901 section remain where it was, because we did talk about moving it in to the book earlier. And I did try it, but it wasn't going to work because of that paragraph.
Yes.
And that's because it just had to be there. And I was very aware when I said, but it's still life in all its beauty and incongruity. So I knew that. And then by then, my working title had brackets, Still Life. And then after that, I read a book by Norman Bryson calling Looking at the Overlooked. Four essays on still life painting. I love still life painting, always have. And the last essay is about still life painting in the feminine space. So for everyone there, it's not gender specific, but feminine space, meaning the energetic of the feminine. And talking about how still life painting is always trivialized by the privileged white male gaze, which was the art world. Mm. So, you know, I'm not having a go, but that's how it was. You know, positions of power. It was always looked down upon. It was domestic. It was kitchens. It wasn't figurative. So who's interested in this? And the essay argues that it is a space of maintaining life and of continuity and familiar objects, which have been so overlooked. But actually, these objects, so a bowl or a jug or a spoon, the function has remained the same and the shape has remained the same. So that must be brilliant if function and use come together. So the brilliance of that and the continuity, and within the continuity of these objects is also memory and family. And I'm going, that is my book. So I call it Still Life, because it is all of those things. And my men are in the kitchen. My men are bringing up the child. And what it's about is that this sort of the parody of the masculine energy, patriarchy, that now has entered every kind of social construct and every place of power is so destructive. And what we need now, we need the feminine. And it's been argued, you know, matrilineal lines of indigenous peoples, we need the feminine, because that is going to save the planet and that is going to heal relationship and that is going to do the most. And so when I was talking to you originally about thinking I was going to write a woman's book, that's actually wrong. It wasn't a woman, but I thought the protagonist, the first one, was going to be a woman, and it was Ulysses. Then you come to the end of the book and go, oh, it was about the feminine. Yeah. It's always been about the feminine. But there's a lead on from Tin Man about men and boys are capable of beautiful things. Our world is only going to change when the men, and we all know good men, so let's keep our good men here, but the other men can adopt and can connect to this feminine energy, because unless they do, nothing is going to change. And so that's what happened. You know what it's, you write, you know that sometimes you have no idea what you're actually saying until you get to the end, or not even when you get to the end, when you start talking with people, and then you just go, so that's my belief. Of course it's my belief.
That's such a satisfying answer for our Australian listeners. That is page 434. Okay, Sarah, the other question that I'm dying to ask you is about Evelyn and yes. the revelation, Evelyn, sorry, and the revelation that she makes at her birthday party, where Ulysses asks, and I won't entirely give it away, but Ulysses asks her a question about her past, something that she has always denied, and she says, oh, yes, of course I was. And it's this huge thing, and yet it's held so lightly, like it's nothing at all. And what it made me think of is, I don't know if you've read Liz Gilbert's The Signature of All Things, but in it...
No, I haven't. I would love that.
Alma, the character, she learns from her father to always keep one last bribe, to keep a jewel sewn in the hem. And it just made me think, this is that jewel sewn in the hem. This is a whole other novel in one line of dialogue, and you choose not to go there. And it's both brilliant and frustrating. And I did the same. I turned to my partner and I said, oh my gosh, she's done this thing. There's a whole other book hidden in the last like chapter and she hasn't gone there. Tell me about that decision and why you made it, please.
Because you know what? Sometimes I just decide to do something. It's not a big, listen, I always said that this was two books, and you can't do that, by the way, unless you actually go to a publisher before you even start writing and say, I've got two books and this is how it's going to play out. Generally, slightly more genre that you can get away with it. You can't apparently get away with it writing this book and going, by the way, it's two books. They don't buy it. And I tell you why they don't buy it, because if the first one tanks, they've got a dud on their hand. So they don't want anything to do with it. But I've always said it was two books. I don't know. Did I leave it open for that? I don't think so. I think it was just around. I loved it because it ties up with Dottie. It's more about Dottie sitting there smoking away going, I know you. I know you. And of course, we are at 1979 and things were still not revealed.
Yes.
And that's the other thing. And a lot of these revelations have come out in the sort of the last 10 years, actually. You know, your little... obviously old, your little old neighbour who you watch, who's really shrunken and you don't have much to do with her, and she drags her bin out in the mornings and she seems quite sweet, you know, you go and you take the film back and she was this vibrant woman who was over in occupied France, you know, sending messages back, because that, we still have that. That generation is almost going. But these remarkable people who we know nothing about are still there. And that's part of what Paul talks about, you know, in his blog, Spitalfields Life. The people he uncovers are just astonishing. And I suppose I have that. I have that very much with older women, that I love older women. I lost two during the pandemic who were really, really important to me. And I just love their history. Mm. And I always write about older women because, you know, I suppose... if ever I get to be old, there's no guarantee, I would like to be them. I would like to have aspects that they have, you know, that people younger than me still want to be around me at that age. And it's usually these kind of storytellers who've had that light touch with life and don't sweat the small stuff because they've seen so much and have been through so much. So I'm toying. I'm wondering whether I don't have anything that I want to write because I still have Evelyn. And it does come back to Evelyn. I went back to Florence. A lot of people have asked me, is there a sequel? You know, And I said, I don't know. I really, really don't know. Because, of course, I got rid of a lot of, you know, almost 20,000 words. Do I? Is there anything I can say that I haven't said about these characters? And I went back to where I always stay. So the hotel is here. And then at that point is where I imagine, where the pensione was. So when I was sitting here on the loggia of this, at the Guadagni, basically, I write about that, I could look over at where I'd placed these characters. And I realized they're not there anymore. Mm. You know, I'm sure you've had the same when you've sort of imagined things. Are they there? And then you go, no, they're not there. They're not there. We're done. We're done. And I usually am done with all the books. There is so much of Evelyn that was left out. I know that. That it couldn't have gone in this book because that was not the narrative engine. But there is, you know, there is a possibility of more. It's just, I don't want it to be a lesser book. I don't want it to be a tagged on book. It's got to be a book in its own right that will have its own kind of rhythm and joy. And maybe I just haven't worked that out yet. So I'm not sure. But maybe the thing that you just said will come into it. Where would one end her story? You know, these are all the things that we talk about as writers.
Yes.
You know, because remember, she meets in 1944. It could stop there. The ending could stop at the beginning of the previous book. You know, these are all the things that will only work if excitement comes into the thought process.
Yes.
So I don't know. But I also like the fact that Dottie got it right. Because we always think that Dottie gets everything wrong because she loves a drink and she's forever like got two fags on the go.
She's
not an alcoholic, but she's just one of these people who have this beautiful capacity for drinking so much. And that you think, oh, but she's a brilliant artist. But you know, and the fact is, you know what? She knew.
She got it.
All along.
I think it's that the satisfaction comes in this kind of joy and triumph in that moment as well, which is so wonderful.
It is. It's not about Evelyn, it's about Dottie in that moment. You go, yes.
Yes.
She's still instinctive. She knows you.
Oh gosh, I love it. There's such satisfying answers as well. I knew that I would run out of time. I've a couple more questions, if you don't mind.
Yes. No, I'm here.
Particularly about
hailstorm outside, so I'm loving talking with you.
Oh, good, excellent. Our listeners,
in a short sleeve shirt.
I know. In the heat out here, I know I'm opening up all the windows. Our listeners really love hearing stories about people kind of navigating the industry as well, you know, with the highs and the lows. And I've noticed particularly, when I went back to see my Tin Man Instagram post, I was like, oh my gosh, she responded to me then as well, that you are particularly engaged, for instance, on Instagram and you respond to people, which is so lovely. So I want to know, and we touched on it a little bit at the start, how you do find the balance between the private writing Sarah and that public facing, and if there's any advice that you might give people about how to manage that.
Really, really hard. People have to, really do have to come to it in their own way, I think. And it's taken me a while because I didn't want to do any of this, and because I am quite private. I'm also quite nervous about, less so now, but I was. So when I went onto Instagram in something like 2014, not very confident in putting out certain beliefs or ideas at that point in time into a public sphere. And I was given the chance to either do Twitter or Instagram. It would always be Instagram. Twitter, I would not touch with it. And I will not. I will not. I don't know. I admire everyone who does it. And people who are so witty and clever in 140 characters. No, I would put them there, you know, slightly contentious. And then I wouldn't sleep for days. So that's not going to happen to me.
Okay.
I love image and I love photographs anyway. And my partner is a photographer. And so I'm very familiar with image and the power of image and what you can put across. So I chose Instagram. And I've actually enjoyed it because it's more like a photograph album, an old fashioned, that I can work out where I was, what I'd seen, what I'd read. And so I approach it like that. It gets a little bit tricky when you're around publication, because it becomes, all I see is the cover of my book. And I don't like that. I don't like that. I find it too me. to me, you know, I don't feel comfortable, but I know that that is what you have to do. That's what the publishers want. It's another form of advertising, publicity. And so I hope there's enough content either side of all of that. That's what I try and work out. But, you know, it's, you just learn to do it. I do try and respond to everybody or most people. And Patsy taught me that, my partner. My partner is slightly younger than me and she's Australian. And so her energy is very different to me. And it's a really beautiful energy. I always find Australians have a very different energy to English. You know, we can be a bit flat, we can be a bit heavy. Whereas if I talk about Patsy, her energy is incredibly sunny. It doesn't mean that she doesn't have incredible depths, but she does have that energy. And I've learned a huge amount from her. She does a lot on Instagram and with imagery. And so I talk to her about responses and so she's been the one that has said, you know, just let go with that. Because when I will start writing, I give myself the chance. When the paperback's out and or the trades have been out in other countries and it's been out for a while, then I give myself the chance to come off it, which strangely is not hard. So what I miss when I do come off it is the fact that I'm just posting little things, which I think are for my friends so they know where I am. But I think, yeah, it's sort of required now. There are some people who don't do it at all, and that's really, you know, good. But they might also be in a position where they can state that they're not going to do it. You know, there are writers who are more established who will not be, and maybe in their kind of their belief it's slightly lowering themselves to do it. You know, pushing themselves, and actually it's their writing is a private sphere, and I absolutely get all of that. So I think you just got to work out how you want to be, and it will evolve. You know, what you're posting, there was a point where you could see, I think you still can, you can see what I'm writing. I tend not to tell people that I'm writing, so I don't do the hashtag I am writing, but you can start to see what I'm posting, where I am, what my interests are and what this book is going to be about. And I think that's worked absolutely for Tin Man and Still Life very, very clearly. And I'm sure that will kind of happen again. And I quite like that because that sort of throws clues out.
Yes, now we're all coded watching Zara's Instagram. So wonderful. I want to ask you too about reading, and partly because in some of the, you know, all of those lists that we have to do when we put out a book about what we read, that I've noticed two of my very favourites, Sarah Waters, who I came very late to, but I'm now, you know, avid fan, and Cloud Street, which was for myself, I think it must have come out when I was about 16 or 17. I studied it in school. I have maybe four copies here. It was an absolute turning point for me understanding what writing could do.
I do.
Oh, there, right there, right there.
Being old and, yeah.
Yeah. And so I know that you have spoken about what a big influence that book was, or the profound effect it had on you. So I wanted to start with Winton and then just go on to reading in general. Yeah. How did you come to Cloud Street and what did it do to you?
Cloud Street wasn't the first book. I read Dirt Music. I think that was probably the first major, I mean, I'm out on a limb here, the first major success, big success that Winton probably had here. I'm sure he had others, but that was the one that everybody read.
Okay.
And I just loved it. It made sense to me, the way he wrote. That's all I know. It made sense to my brain when I was reading it, you know, the eye and the sort of the nervous system and all of those things. And then, of course, I went through a lot. Love Riders. I think The Riders is a magnificent novel as well. I mean, there's not Boy Behind the Curtain, his essays. There's nothing that I don't love about his writing. And then I eventually read Cloud Street. So when would that be? Probably 10 years ago now, maybe before. And I just remember, I love the poetry. I love the fact that he makes up words. I love the vernacular. I love the ensemble piece. It was theatrical. I love the fact that he was giving us an insight into many characters' lives, even though that we did have really the main two stroke four protagonists, but two really. And I found it immensely satisfying. I found it a very, it's a funny word, sexy, but you know what I mean? He writes, I think this is the other thing, he writes sex really well. Mm. He writes relationships really well. And not many people do that. Mm. And I learned how to write those scenes through him. He gave me permission to really just, with abandon, write scenes and to feel confident in writing sex scenes and relationship scenes in that way. Mm. And I do now. I'm not a, you know, waves crashing, shells opening kind of.
Oh, right. Thank goodness for that.
We just, it's like you either write it or you don't write it.
Or you leave it out.
Write it out. So I do. And that's him. So, you know, he just writes. He's so respectful of people. I think that's the other thing, that you might be writing about people who are not necessarily where you are today. And I think that's the one thing that he always gives people is dignity. Even dodgy people that he writes, he still gives them a dignity and a humanity, which I think we owe that. So... there's many, many qualities that I admire and have learned from. You know, these writers are my learning.
Mm. You said that before. You said when you're reading, you know, don't stop reading brilliant writers. So you are obviously one of the tribe of writers who continue to read while they are writing and not one who says, no, I can't read anything else while I'm writing.
Sometimes you don't read because you get this... Certainly was still alive. I had so much to read. Mm. What I won't read, I probably wouldn't read any of the books that publishers send me.
And there's quite a few of those, I imagine, that arrive at your house, Sarah.
Yeah. I would go to my stable of familiars and my stable of people who are so up there, are so unreachable in their talent, that there is almost a sense of wonderment and comfort in reading them, because all I have to do is aspire to just be a better person and a better writer, because I can't be them. Mm. And there's, you know, it's a funny tension that you can get between ego and writing and all of those things that come into it when you're doing it. And sometimes you just need to go with those people, because there will always be something that they sort out. It might just be how they start a chapter and you go, oh my God, that's, you're not taking their how to start a chapter. You take your own version of that. But there are ways, you know, that's why it is interesting. But you've got to choose which ones and you've got to choose what's going to work for you. So still life was third person. I couldn't read first person because at those very quiet days where you're struggling and you are reading a first person, which just flips, and, you know, especially when it's slightly memoir-y and you go,
yeah,
why didn't I write first person? Well, you don't need that. It's unhelpful.
Yes. Yes.
So it's really about choosing. And so I have Sarah Waters, I have Tim Winton, I have Colm Devine, I have Toni Morrison. You know, Toni Morrison, especially when I was writing Marvelous, totally different. But obviously in me, there was still something in her writing that went through that whole process and allowed me to write something else. So I think it's that. I think it's, again, it's something that people need to come to and find their way and find what are the writers. And if people choose not to write, then that's okay too. Not to read while they're writing, that's absolutely okay too. Sometimes you just need the absolute immersion of your own world, I think.
Can I ask you, I emailed you earlier this morning for you because I very foolishly had forgotten to give you a heads up about this question, that I was going to ask you to recommend a novel, a debut novel if you could, but also any novel that you think that we should be reading right now.
Well, two. One is a debut novel, but it's got a bit of a catch to it. It's called The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, and it's by an American, Black American writer called Honoré Fanon Jeffers, and it's 790-odd pages.
Wow.
And it's basically in fiction form. It is giving you the colonial and racial story of America through the multi-generational lives of one particular family, and interspersed, so it's present past, bit of present past, and it's interspersed with the writings of this scholar and activist called W.E.B. Du Bois. And I think it's amazing and brilliant. I mean, it's so brilliant. And I could have read another 800 pages. And the rub is that it's about as much of a debut novel as Lincoln in the Bardo was.
Yeah, right.
So it's her first novel, but she's been a writer of poetry for decades. But that's, she's just switched form. And that's what I love about it. So it's incredibly assured and muscular, and all those brilliant things. But it is, you know, if you want to know about why America is the way it is today, and has been with, you know, this horrendousness of, well, gosh, for decades, but especially, you know, these last 3 years, it's all there. It's all there. I mean, you know, what happened to the indigenous cultures even before, you know, slavery happened, and then, and how those two things merged as well. It's just fantastic. And then, not a debut, but a book I'm reading at the moment, and I think, because I'm always interested in, you know, men and boys being capable of beautiful things, this book.
Oh.
I haven't read it. You know, it came out 2 years ago.
Yes.
So it was probably published when we were all locked down. And I haven't finished it. I'm blown away by it. And its idea of male friendship. And I say straight male friendship, because I think that's also quite a very, very interesting
point. I have not finished it either. We're looking at Mayflies by Andrew O'Hagan. But I have heard him speak via video link at a festival that I was at. And he was in a small caravan, I think, by the Northern Sea, writing something. And it was just most beautiful.
He's talked about this is a place where he goes.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's I think it's very special, and it's got the most stunning poetry and tender. It's tender. And how he brings this gang of friends alive, and they were, you know, in the 80s, and you feel it all, and you can, and then he cleverly intersperses it with just letting you know that it's a writer looking back. So you think you're actually going with that time, but no, it's still, this is memoir. And just from those little moments and those little snippets, you know that it's sort of elegiac, you know.
Tender is certainly a word I think we could use for all of your books, Sarah. And also the joy. I wanted to use the quote where you said of Still Life, I wanted to write a story of joy and entertainment as a form of resistance, and also to recharge the batteries for the long fight ahead. And I think, you know, particularly today and the kind of news that we're dealing with in the world at the moment, after all that we've had with COVID and now the rest of the things that continue to go on and then start up afresh, what a joy it is to have your words and your thinking in the world, and that it has set us up for the long road ahead, this book and your other works. And I can't wait. I can't wait to see what you decide to do next.
I've loved this. And thank you. I've just loved talking with you so much. And good luck to you with everything that you're doing. And
thank you so much. Words
and your thinking, you know, because just trying to get them out there, aren't we?
That's what we're all doing. Yeah. Sarah Winman, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please share the love on socials at The First Time Pod, on Insta and Twitter, or by leaving a review wherever you listen. To support our work in season 6, you can become a patron via patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast, or check out our work and upcoming events and workshops on katemildenhall.com or katherinecollette.com. We'll be back with brand new episodes in March 2023.